Following are comments on William Shakespeare's Richard II, Act I. We were not born to sue, but to command. Richard II judges a quarrel between Mowbray and Bolingbroke, who accuses Mowbray of complicity in the murder of the Duke of Gloucester. Richard orders a trial by combat. Act I, Scene I begins with King Richard II trying to arbitrate a quarrel between Thomas Mowbray, Duke of Norfolk, and Henry Bolingbroke, Duke of Hereford, both of whom bandy words of high honor at length. This is an important test of Richard's power, coming in 1397, some 20 years after his accession in 1377, when he was 10 years old, following the death of his grandfather, Edward III. He has spent much of his reign trying to avoid being controlled by such powerful lords as Mowbray and his cousin Bolingbroke. Henry Bolingbroke's initial words sound almost contentless. Quote unquote, "Thou art a traitor and a miscreant, too good to be so and too bad to live," he declares boldly to Mowbray. Act 1, Scene 1, lines 39 through 40. The accused shoots back something more like an insult than a defense. Quote unquote, "I do defy him, and I spit at him, call him a slanderous coward and a villain." Act 1, Scene 1, lines 60 through 61. These two could go on for some time slinging barbs, but Richard II steers Bolingbroke towards an actual set of accusations. First, he says, Mowbray misappropriated funds intended for the king's military efforts. Secondly, he claims Mowbray has been responsible for all of the fierce opposition and plotting against Richard II since Wat Tyler and John Ball's Peasants' Revolt of 1381. Third, Mowbray is tagged with the killing of Henry and Richard's uncle, Thomas of Woodstock, Duke of Gloucester, the youngest of Edward III's 5 adult sons. Richard claims that he will judge impartially between the accuser and defendant, though this promise seems absurd because he himself was most likely involved in the killing of Gloucester in September 1397. The man was his uncle, to be sure, but Richard had reason to hate him and want him out of the way. Gloucester sought to direct Richard's kingship, opposing the king's counselors, the earls of Suffolk, Michael de la Pole, and Oxford, Robert de Vere. Gloucester steered the lord's appellant, who nearly deposed the king in 1388. It makes sense, then, that Richard's real agenda here is to stop all talk of the Duke of Gloucester's death in 1397, and that can't happen if Bolingbroke and Mowbray keep tossing insults and accusations at each other. Mowbray sounds increasingly guilty and even admits to trying to have Gaunt ambushed and killed. In any event, Richard and Gaunt, who was Bolingbroke's father, try to reconcile Bolingbroke and Mowbray, but it immediately becomes clear that neither man finds King Richard II a sufficiently commanding presence to obey. Exasperated, Richard declares, quote unquote, "We were not born to sue, but to command," and quickly orders the two men to settle their differences in a public duel to the death. Act 1, Scene 1, line 196. A public spectacle in which the winner will be thought to have fought with truth on his side presents an obvious risk to the king if Mowbray should be slain, but his theater of deflection has not achieved what he wanted, so for the time being he has been forced into this course of action. Edward's 7 sons, whereof thyself art one, were as 7 vials of his sacred blood. The widowed Duchess of Gloucester tries to shame John of Gaunt into intervening on the side of Bolingbroke and the dead Duke of Gloucester against Mowbray, but he won't commit to it. In Act 1, Scene 2, the Duchess of Gloucester, wife of the murdered Duke of Gloucester, urges her brother-in-law, John of Gaunt, to intervene on the side of his son Bolingbroke and his brother, Gloucester, against Thomas Mowbray. Her initial appeal is to the pull of kinship. The 7 sons of Edward III were, she says, quote unquote, as 7 vials of his sacred blood, or seven fair branches springing from one root? Act 1, Scene 2, lines 12 through 13. How can he stand by and watch his own father's royal blood in Gloucester poured into the earth and not speak out? But Gaunt responds with a combination of weariness and theology. His text is drawn from St. Paul's epistle to the Romans, 12:19, quote unquote, "Vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord," which in turn draws upon Deuteronomy 32:35. The passage quoted is from BibleGateway.com. If we go by the divine right of kings theory that flourished in Elizabethan Jacobean England, it is not up to John of Gaunt to correct or punish his God-anointed sovereign. Gaunt despairs of reforming Richard II's misbehavior. The Duchess then offers a theory that must have occurred often to Shakespeare himself, since, as Jonathan Bate points out in Soul of the Age, A Biography of the Mind of William Shakespeare, Random House 2010, pages 61 through 63, we hear a great deal from the playwright about the chaos that is sure to ensue when degree and rank are not respected and everyone starts asserting powers grounded in nothing but their own ambition, desire, and willfulness. The Duchess says bluntly, quote unquote, "In suffering thus thy brother to be slaughtered, thou showest the naked pathway to thy life, teaching stern murder how to butcher thee." Act 1, Scene 2, lines 30 through 32. If Richard can cut one of his uncles down, she reasons, he can do so to another uncle whenever it suits him. But the trouble is, Gaunt is old and ill and soon to meet his maker, so the Duchess's argument doesn't convince him that he has any business acting against his nephew, King Richard II. The Duchess is resigned to Gaunt's inaction and says finally, quote unquote, "Desolate, desolate will I hence and die. The last leave of thee takes my weeping eye." Act 1, Scene 2, lines 73 through 74. Eleanor de Bohun, spelled B-O-H-U-N, Shakespeare's Duchess, died in October 1399, only days after Richard II was deposed. "Four lagging winters and four wanton springs end in a word, such is the breath of kings." Richard stops the duel and banishes Bolingbroke for several years, while Mowbray is banished for life. Gaunt laments that he won't live to see his son return, which earns Bolingbroke 4 years off his banishment. Richard frets over reports of Bolingbroke's popularity as he departs from England. In Act 1, Scene 3, the trial by combat is come due. Thomas Mowbray and Henry Bolingbroke open the scene with formulaic language whose underlying purpose in medieval times was to restrain, but also to justify, acts of violence. They follow the prescription set for them by the king's marshal. Quote unquote, "In God's name and the king's, say who thou art, and why thou com'st thus knightly clad in arms, against what man thou com'st, and what's thy quarrel?" But after so much has been said and arranged, Richard decides to stop the proceedings. He withdraws with his advisors, takes his time, and returns with a pronouncement that no doubt shocks all present. He banishes Bolingbroke for a period of 10 years, and Thomas Mowbray for life. His reasoning, at least publicly, is that, quote unquote, "Our kingdom's earth should not be soiled with that dear blood which it hath fostered." Act 1, Scene 3, lines 125 through 126. Bolingbroke takes the news somewhat stoically, though he shows himself a realist. He cannot, as Richard will do later on, imagine his circumstances to be better than they really are. Of his predicament, he says poetically, quote unquote, "Oh, who can hold a fire in his hand by thinking on the frosty Caucasus? Or cloy the hungry edge of appetite by bare imagination of a feast." Act 1, Scene 3, lines 258 through 261. Thomas Mowbray reacts with more passion, lamenting that his native tongue will now become useless to him forevermore. Quote unquote, "Within my mouth you have enjailed my tongue, doubly portcullised with my teeth and lips, and dull, unfeeling, barren ignorance is made my jailer to attend on me." Act 1, Scene 3, lines 161 through 164. Richard is not interested in Thomas Mowbray's problems with English, but he is interested in ensuring that these two powerful lords do not combine against him while in exile. He orders them as follows, quote unquote, "You never shall, so help you truth and heaven, embrace each other's love in banishment, nor ever look upon each other's face." Act 1, Scene 3, lines 178 through 180. When Richard notes how heartbroken John of Gaunt seems, he shortens Bolingbroke's sentence by 4 years. This scarcely relieves Gaunt's heartache, since he will be dead shortly. But Bolingbroke himself notes in Richard's gesture the tremendous power that a king wields. Quote unquote, "How long a time lies in one little word! 4 lagging winters and 4 wanton springs end in a word. Such is the breath of kings." Act 1, Scene 3, lines 207 through 209. Is this the seed of Bolingbroke's later determination to take the crown for himself? "Pray heaven we may make haste and come too late." Richard makes plans for a military campaign in Ireland, but needs funds for it, so he resorts to onerous tax schemes, sure to anger everyone in England. Richard hears that Gaunt is dying and responds with shocking callousness. In Act 1, Scene 4, the significance of what Bolingbroke said about the power that a king commands becomes obvious to us when we hear about Richard's reaction to Bolingbroke's departure for the continent. The king notices what a gifted politician Bolingbroke is. He sees, as he says to O'Merrill, quote unquote, "what reverence he did throw away on slaves, wooing poor craftsmen with the craft of souls, and patient underbearing of his fortune, as 'twere to banish their effects with him." Act 1, Scene 4, lines 27 through 30. In Henry IV, Part 1, this same Henry, older now, will lecture his dissolute son Prince Hal about not spending too much time with the common sort of people. But here, in the late 1390s, he shows skills similar to those of a good politician in a modern democracy. To be fair, in Richard II, Henry isn't actually placing himself at the commoners' level. He is merely acknowledging their existence and showing gratitude for their affection. Shakespeare's Richard II can be roguishly charming, but he is by no means a man of the people. The king is therefore distrustful of Bolingbroke's abilities and his intentions as he leaves the country. Still, there isn't much time to devote to the newly exiled Bolingbroke and Mowbray. Richard is more taken with his Irish wars. When the king hears that John of Gaunt is on his deathbed, he jokes that Gaunt's estate, illegitimately snatched away from its rightful inheritor, Henry Bolingbroke, will line his pockets for the Irish campaign, and utters the immortal bit of insouciance, quote unquote, "Pray heaven we may make haste and come too late." Act 1, Scene 4, line 63. Thanks for listening. This audio lecture was recorded on Friday, September 26th, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume, genre-based format.